remember at the beginning of the pandemic, people scratch their heads and be like, why isn't Africa being wiped out? Like, why are tens of thousands of people dying in Western Europe with the most sophisticated public healthcare systems?
There's a story that is being told to Europeans by Europeans about the necessity of these violent borders.
The myth that some countries struggled because they were poor and others didn't because they were wealthy is a complete fiction.
I believe the path to building a better future is by asking better questions. I'm Nanjala Nyabola. As a writer and political analyst, I'm always struck by this false binary between communism and capitalism. Have we really exhausted every possible political ideology?
I'm Nisreen Malik. As a journalist, I see a pattern of the establishment pushing for a return to an unjust status quo. What does business as usual mean for people who've endured vaccine apartheid?
I'm worried about increasingly discriminatory migration and border policies. How many lives might have been saved if countries focused more on global justice than on shutting borders?
In crises, existing divides deepen. Gender and race, class and economic inequalities become worse. We are even weaker now. So what can we do about it?
Join us as we explore these issues together on Studio B Unscripted.
Nanjala, I have been so excited to have this conversation with you. A lot has happened in the past 2 years. A lot of change has happened. What really stands out for you that you think really defines or has arrested your attention and made you think that this is really what the pandemic has been about?
I mean, well, first of all, I'm really excited to be speaking with you as well. I remember the moments when the first doses of vaccine came out, right? And you had all of these people in the United States especially, but across Europe, getting vaccinated and then sort of entering very quickly into this imagination of post-pandemic life. Mm-hmm. This is all over. Everything's going to be fine now. Mm. And I remember being in Nairobi and just looking around and thinking, how is this over when... You're not just telling us that we're not going to get vaccines, but you're telling us we might never get vaccines, right? Because in April of 2020, that was still the conversation that, you know, we'll get to you when we get to you. And that is going to be the story of this pandemic for me. It's going to be that inequality, but it's not inevitable, right? Mm. It's a consequence of choice. It's a consequence of refusing to help.
I think we underestimate also how much of our experience of the pandemic was refracted through lens that we had no control over. We had not decided. You know, the way these stories were told to us, the way death tolls were reported, there were stories that could have been said or told very early on that would have made things easier, either in terms of the West response to the pandemic or the global response to the pandemic in the South. There was a different way to approach this, which is to say, we have made ourselves vulnerable, and therefore we are kind of all responsible for what's going on, as opposed to, we shouldn't share our vaccines because we are powerful and others are weak.
Yeah.
The myth that some countries struggled because they were poor and others didn't because they were wealthy is a complete fiction.
It's a complete fiction. And I like that you said vulnerability because, well, this is something, again, a lot of Africans, different African countries will have experienced the most recent pandemic before this, which was the HIV/AIDS pandemic.
Yeah.
Completely different. at the worst moments in Kenya, we had a prevalence rate of 10%. So one in every 10 Kenyans was testing HIV/AIDS positive. It changed everything. But that also meant that we had to build systems around that. And there's a resilience that is coming from all of these systems, all of these community health systems that were designed to respond to HIV/AIDS. So we have a lot of community healthcare workers, right? People will go to even the most remote towns in Kenya, and you'll find there's one person who's been trained in messaging and all of that. And so when I think about vulnerability and I think about the pandemic, there's this narrative that rich countries have about how public health should respond.
Yeah.
People will say things like, we're not going to give vaccines because the Africans will not know what to do with them.
Yeah.
And it's like, there is no continent, you know, probably Asia would be comparable, where people have more experience getting medicine into people's hands. So a lot of people in wealthy countries don't have the community healthcare systems, don't know what it is to translate the life cycle of a virus into 44 different languages in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And we did that, you know? I remember I was in rural Kenya in 2020, very, very small town in northern Kenya, like a cluster of 20 huts, really. And I went to get water, and on the door of the kiosk is a poster, COVID-19 awareness poster, in this local language, which probably has like 20,000, 30,000 speakers, right? This is in 2020, like 6 months into, you know, the worst of the pandemic. And I just remember looking at that poster and thinking, this doesn't really get captured in the story of this pandemic.
Yeah,
it's not attuned to see this thing, this way in which people communities will rally and respond. And so this is tied to the issue of image making and the obligation of the people who make the images and tie the stories. I've gone through this pandemic with this sense that we are losing the fine print of resilience and vulnerability. And we're focusing on technical things, you know, and not the fact that pandemics happen to people.
Yeah,
you have to understand how people respond to messaging.
Yeah.
What are their fears? And I think that for us, for a lot of people who are in Africa, in Asia, especially because those are two regions that have been deeply affected by, you know, really big diseases, there are things that have changed so much since HIV/AIDS that we are so scared of disease at this scale because we've seen it and we don't argue about masks
like it's been very weird for us to both fly in from the African continent into the UK and just be like no one is wearing masks
you know.
It's
we
so
don't
strange.
Argue about them because it's like it's the least I can do it's the least that I can do because you know in Hong Kong, they've survived the bird
SARS,
flu, SARS, right? So you tell someone to put a mask over their face, like, yes, absolutely. Not just for me, but for the people around me.
This is where sort of the response to the pandemic becomes just not just about people, but about political culture. Yeah. And I think one thing that has been sort of tragically under-discussed is how, like what you said earlier, like we focus on very technical solutions and technical reasons why the pandemic has ravaged people so much. But there's also sort of subjective conditions. There's lifestyle. There's population distribution. There's people's behavior. There's demographic patterns. So like, I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, people scratch their heads and be like, why isn't Africa being wiped out? Like, why are tens of thousands of people dying in Western Europe with the most sophisticated public healthcare systems, allegedly, in the West? But, you know, the death toll in Africa was, sure, there must have been an allowance for underreporting, but still, you know, the allowance could not have covered tens of thousands of...
You would notice.
...fatalities. You would notice if, like, tens of thousands of people were dying. And people focused on the technical, right? Is it because, you know, there's... You know, how is it happening? There's no ventilators, there's no treatment. But no one focused on the sort of societal changes the way that there are, for example, no old people's homes. Mm. I'm not saying this is a kind of cultural one-upmanship, but we have to understand that diseases, they attack
people.
They don't attack systems. So I think we have actually a couple of questions.
Nesrin, I really, really enjoyed your book about these sort of toxic myths and narratives. And my question is this. If these toxic myths are so, you know, fun and enticing and validating, especially for those who are benefiting from them, whereas sort of more reasonable human discourse is perhaps less exciting, you know, we've got our sugar of toxic myths, our vegetables of normal human discourse, how do we get people to eat their vegetables?
That is such a great
question.
So toxic myths are about basically notions and ideas of cultural superiority that we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better than others, simply. Like, all countries have these myths that distinguish them from others. For example, in the UK, it is the myth of a global empire that distinguished the United Kingdom from the rest of the world. In the US, it's this myth of
the American
The American dream, exceptionalism. And so the question is, how do we, you know, these myths are so compelling, how do we get people to basically eat their greens, eat their porridge, and tell themselves stories that are more, that are closer to the truth, which is that, you know, countries become what they are by happenstance, luck, and sometimes pillaging and robbery. And I think the answer is that we just have to instill in our public culture and leadership culture the importance of that, because it creates social cohesion. It's not just going to be good for a certain group of people. It's going to make society less conflicted. It's going to make it easier to create consensus amongst different groups of people. It's going to create a less divisive political culture. And the example I always like to give is that of Germany after World War II, and how much time and money was spent in creating a public education and public awareness culture that shed light on what happened in the Holocaust. So when I reported in Germany for the book about the resistance to this attitude, it didn't happen easily. There was so much resistance to the kind of modern, contemporary German approach to its record in the Holocaust. What people told me constantly was, we sold it to the politicians. We told them, your life will be easier. You will get more votes if you create a culture that is consensual, that is kind, that is accurate, that is about creating a sense of strength and identity via self-awareness, then you will turn that green into a sweet, right? You will turn it from something you kind of have to do because it's the right thing to do, to something that you want to do because it makes you feel good. It makes you feel special. And the Germans are so proud. They are so proud of their post-Holocaust culture because they're like, we constantly talk about it. We constantly we don't deny it. It has become a point of pride for them. And so when I see cultures really driven apart, rent asunder by these arguments about slavery, imperialism, colonialism, I'm like, there is an easier way. You can actually make yourself good, feel good by really owning, apologizing, repairing for, giving yourself some status that you've done a good thing. And that will be a positive status. It'll be a positive exceptionalism as opposed to a negative one. We're beginning to see that in the UK. We're actually beginning to see it. We're beginning to see people begin to associate a new attitude towards imperialism and colonialism.
But I don't mean to be a skeptic about this, but do you think that... because there's obviously backlash, right?
Yes.
And like what we're experiencing right now is the people who don't want to let go of that old narrative and want this return to this mythical, you know, the sun never sets on the British Empire and want to restore that myth. And so I guess the next stage is, how do you then, because that process of turning the green into a sweet is, someone is going to have to lose, right?
Yeah.
If you are accustomed to privilege, equality feels like loss.
Yeah.
You know, do you think that there is enough, I mean, knowledge there, or even willingness there to sit with that discomfort? Or are we, I mean, going to continue to endure this period of backlash, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, we will. Yeah. It's going to take a while. I think, I mean, one of the things that we have to be, we have to make our peace with, and I think sometimes we can get impatient. Mm. It's not about them being comfortable with change. It's about us being comfortable with their resistance, because it will take time.
Yeah. Next question.
My question is for Nangela. Your book, Traveling with While Black, was very meaningful to me. And my question for you is, what was the most surprising thing that you learned while researching and writing this book?
I write in the book about my experience in Palermo, in Sicily. And so I actually went there because just after the worst of the Mediterranean crisis from 2017. And I went there with an anxiety of being a Black woman writing a story about Black migration at a time when so much violence had become normalized. Mm. And what was I going to find? How was I going to be received? I was there by myself. And what I found in Italy was, in Palermo especially, was Europe divided unto itself. Mm. That there was a sense in this small town that what was happening was deeply unjust, but they didn't know what to do about it. Mm. So because they're on the front line, when bodies wash up, they wash up on their beaches. When people, when boats capsize, when the ships, you know, rescue people, they end up in their ports. They're not sitting in Milan and in Rome and in Brussels dealing with abstractions. They're dealing with real people. Mm. And you see the same thing in Hungary, you know, with the Hungary refugee crisis. It's the people who actually have to go and fish those bodies out of the barbed wire. They have a completely different moral structure from the people who are sitting in the capital passing all of these really, really cruel refugee laws. And so I remember going up to the mayor and asking him, what do you think about what's happening? And he said to me, I believe that in 50 years, Europe will be facing charges of crimes against humanity for what they're doing in the Mediterranean Sea. Wow. And I was completely stunned, because I didn't expect to hear that from a person who had power at a time when the line was, this is an acceptable cost to defending European borders. And I just have always found borders to be completely violent things. Nobody leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. People don't just flee unless there's something really difficult. So for me, the experience of witnessing came with this realization. Again, we talked about stories and narrative. There is a story that is being told to Europeans by Europeans about the necessity of these violent borders, that the people who are on the front line, the people who are having to dredge the bodies out of the water, are experiencing something completely different. Mm. And that story doesn't necessarily get captured in either direction. So that was a really big surprise for me, and it's something that I'm still, you know, working with.
Yeah, I feel like all the questions come back to how do we get people motivated to tell a different story. I think we have another question.
Hi, my name is Shruti. I'm from Nairobi. My question is for Nangela. So my experience in 2020 was that all of our judgments and all of our actions to do with COVID were all kind of guided by Western voices in Kenya. So that could be the embassies or other UN bodies. Did you find that the Western voice was given more importance in Kenya? And if yes, why do you think that is?
I spent a lot of time in that first year of the pandemic outside the capital, sort of speaking to people in small informal settlements, rural areas, and things like that. I remember mobilizing to buy these jerry cans, 20-liter jerry cans, to put in every single home so that, because these people don't have running water, to put in every single home so that people would have a source of water for washing their hands.
Right.
And that story didn't get reported anywhere, not even in Kenyan media, didn't get reported anywhere. When the WHO released the official guidelines of how to combat, you know, the 3 points, wash your hands, mask, there was a mobilization to have that material translated into every single local language in Kenya within days. Mm. People volunteered off of the translations, didn't get reported anywhere. And so it's not always a case of that the foreign governments dominated the action or the reaction. It's more of a case that we are attuned to listen to the stories of power, that our systems are attuned to picking up those voices and amplifying them, so that when a certain embassy donates $10,000 to buy masks or whatever, you know, there's going to be a launch. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a photograph. There's going to be handshaking, probably be a couple of flags in the background, right? But when communities come together and provide for each other, it doesn't get the same amplification.
Yeah.
For me, it really comes down to people did so much that didn't get captured and didn't get told. And it's not going in the archives. The archives will just record it as the Kenyan government received 10,000 masks from, you know, this other government.
Well, it's going in the archives for this conversation.
I hope so.
That's a start. Next question, please.
Hi. You both spoke about how pandemics happen to people, and we have seen how this pandemic has totally obliterated the education system. How do we then, as citizens, help to ensure that we do not end up with a lost generation of learners?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is actually a global issue. So there are people who lived in countries where some children, despite school shutting down, had access to online education, and some children didn't have access to online education. So what will likely happen is that we will have sort of a generation lost along the lines of their access to the tools and the privileges, basically, of education. What needs to happen, basically, after this pandemic or during these stages of the pandemic is a sort of Marshall Plan, right? There needs to be a sort of global pot in which people bung a bunch of money and they allocate it to certain sort of infrastructure rehabilitation projects. And one of those should be education. And what I fear is that we will focus on the kind of the top line issues, you know, things like restoring the economy, getting our GDP back strong, you know, stimulating consumer habits, like all this stuff, all the technical stuff that give us a sense that our society and our economy is healthy, is going to take precedence.
I mean, I feel like that's a really powerful observation, and embedded in that is this separation that's happened between the economy, whatever that weird animal energy is, and life, right? Yeah. And real life. We've allowed this weird mythical energy to separate itself from the reality of our lives, and it is dominant over everything.
Yeah.
All hail the economy. That is all, you know, everything must be done in service of the economy, whatever that means. And I guess it just kind of goes back to the thing that we were talking about, which is the pandemic didn't create all of these problems so much as it showed us our true colors.
Yeah. And it showed us actually what we invest in as real and what we invest in as kind of not real or irrelevant. And it's become clear that we think the economy is real, but that the people who make up the economy that we need to create this economy are not real somehow. So great questions. Thank you so much, everyone. I really, really enjoyed that. And thank you, Nanjala.
Thank you. Nasreen, such a pleasure to be with you today, carrying on our conversation and talking about the world, the state of the world. You know, when you think about all of the realignments that are happening in East Africa, whether we're talking about the revolution in Sudan, we're talking about the conflict in Ethiopia, mm-hmm. the conflict in Somalia. What do you think it tells us about where the world is right now?
Well, what's really interesting is our generation from North Africa and the Middle East that grew up, experienced the Arab Spring and then the aftermath of the Arab Spring, one thing that it taught us, and that I think is a really salutary tale, is the false promise of technology. Mm. There is this image I will never forget from the protests in Egypt. It was such an exciting time where somebody had graffitied on four sort of shop front doors, had graffitied the logos of Twitter, Facebook, I think Google. And that was a time when the promise of digital platforms, the promise of social media, was that it had single-handedly overthrown the most entrenched authoritarian regimes across the Middle East and North Africa. I still can't believe it happened for the 5 minutes that it did. But what then happened after the Arab Spring was a sort of retrenchment, a return to the status quo that became even more violent, even more authoritarian. And we're kind of living with Arab dictatorship 2.0. But in that lesson, what these new leaders learned, sort of the Sisis and the Bashar al-Assads, that the social media space is as dangerous as the street, if not more dangerous. So it came to be policed as much as the street was policed. And that lesson, that understanding, was catastrophic. Because what happens now is that you can't protest in the street, but if you post anything on social media in many countries across the Arab world and North Africa, the government has such a sophisticated understanding and such a sophisticated surveillance mechanism that you can be imprisoned for a TikTok video, which happened in Egypt.
Yeah.
You can be sent down for Facebook statuses complaining about like dirty streets. And so the tech space, the digital media space, over the past 2 years, because we've all been in our homes, has gained so much more significance, but is still a place where the power jostles with the people.
Yeah.
When the Sudanese revolution happened, social media again had that promise, right? It again had that capacity to bring people together and to overthrow this dictator, Omar al-Bashir, who was there for 30 years. And then the lesson was learned very quickly. And when a counter-coup happened and the second revolution took place and is taking place at the moment with lots of people out on the streets protesting the new military junta in Sudan, their internet access is being shut down. So I think Sudan was off the grid for internet access for a good 2-3 weeks after the latest coup. And so the tech space now is a sort of, it's like a tap. Sometimes it opens and it flows and you get this amazing momentum, particularly as I've seen in my home country of Sudan, to get people out on the streets, to get them to fight valiantly against, you know, another military dictatorship. But at the same time, I am seeing accounts of vigilante paramilitary forces on Instagram who are from the Sudanese military government. And so I'm like, how is this space something that we can take advantage of when all the powerful people are squatting there with their completely unfiltered propaganda? Everything is up for grabs. There's lots of good that can be done with it, but lots of very powerful forces and very weak regulation that mean that its promise is very fragile.
Yeah. Do you think that the companies get that? You know, I really don't, and I'll tell you why. And this East Africa, I think, is kind of like a crucible for a lot of these challenges. And one of the things that stands out for me with Ethiopia is a lot of the platforms didn't, quote unquote, speak Ethiopian languages, no content moderation or whatever, until 2019.
Wow.
Fairly late in the game. And by this point, this culture of, disseminating hate speech, people squatting on, you know, powerful people passing on, saying two things, you know, saying one thing in the English version of the post and something completely different in the non-English version of the post, it's already become normalized, right?
Yeah.
And I just sometimes feel like they don't understand, A, the size and the scope of what they've taken on, because Sudanese people are fighting for their freedom. They're fighting for their lives, right? And so for you being the tech company, giving this blue tick is, you know, playing nice with power.
Yeah.
For them, it's endorsing, normalizing, you know, giving power to someone who is destroying them.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like that gap in understanding is more harmful than they're willing to internalize.
Mm.
Mostly because when you break it down, if they were to pay attention to that gap carefully, it would cost them a lot of money.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? It would cost them a lot of money to speak, you know, speak quote unquote all of Ethiopia's languages, 110 million people.
But how much do you think that there is an incentive not to understand, right?
I think that's changing. I think for a long time there was an incentive because the idea was, who do we assume the tech user is?
Yeah.
You know, is an English-speaking, upper-middle-class white man who has an ability to interface with power.
Right.
Right? When someone... When a pipe bursts down his street, he can email his council and the council will do something about it. So I don't have to, as you know, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, I don't have to do anything for this guy because someone else will.
Yeah.
Whereas for the average African, Asian, Latin American internet user doesn't have that experience with power.
Mm.
You know, when this pipe bursts on the street, it stays
burst
until someone decides to fix it. And so I feel like it's changing now. The calculus is changing. Is it too late?
Yeah.
Are we trying to, you know, shut the stable doors after the horse has bolted? Because the kind of violence that we've seen that can be connected directly to the lack of investment in understanding these markets, it's just tremendous. You know, Myanmar, Ethiopia. You know, right now in the Central African Republic, and this is one country that always stays with me because it's a country that no one really pays attention to.
Yeah.
They've been at war for the better part of the last 15 years, and their misinformation campaigns being driven by Western, Eastern governments, and it doesn't crack, you know, the surface of the news cycle.
Mm.
It doesn't become a thing that is a red flag that we should be paying attention to.
Mm.
And I look at that and I think, have the lessons been learned?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because I think sometimes we tend to talk about social media as this separate plane that has its own rules and has its own referees. But I think it also interplays quite a complex way with actual media and tries to get actual media to pick it up and become viral.
Yeah.
There's like lots of virality chasing going on. So how much do you think kind of storytelling aspect also plays into the ways in which tech platforms have become motivated in different ways?
When traditional media retreats, lack of funding, lack of finances, advertising crisis, whatever, social media starts to take up a little bit of that space.
Mm.
And so there is a reinforcing cycle. There is the things that do rise to the top, the things that are the most viral, the things that are most being discussed. Someone's going to pick it up and is going to put it on the 10 o'clock news. It's going to put it on the 7 o'clock news. It's going to put it on the radio. And so even people who are not on social media will find themselves discussing that story.
Exactly.
There is also, though, that the rules are slightly different in who gets to decide what's the thing that rises to the top.
Right.
And this is one of the things that a lot of companies, a lot of governments, they've started to figure out. They can game the system. I can buy the hashtag.
Yeah.
I can buy, you know, and put a couple of bots. Again, I go back to the Central African Republic. Even Facebook itself conceded that they had found networks of what they call coordinated inauthentic behavior by foreign governments to influence what goes viral. And so there is this thing where the there is an increasing awareness, I think, with the social media companies that they're kind of playing in the media space. But I feel like there's still this lack of accountability, I guess.
Yeah, it feels very Wild West at the moment.
Yeah.
What I think is most worrying, particularly in the context of the pandemic, is how we consume our media, or how we interact with each other, has become about little sachets, little parcels of information, little things that you can pop. You know what I mean? Like a pill or a sweet or a snack. And this is not some moral panic about how we've lost our attention span, which we have done.
For sure.
But I think the way that things are parceled now means that we experience the world, or we consume the world, in bite-sized chunks, no pun intended. So like, we always stay in gear one, which means, in the context of the pandemic, that it was impossible to get people to pay attention to anything apart from the most basic facts about why things were going wrong. If you want to talk about COVID-19 vaccines to the South, all you need is one viral story about 10,000 vaccines destroyed because they had expired because there was no storage facility in some part of Africa, and that will be the story, and it will be clipped and it will become viral, and then there is no way to get beyond that story. And so I think that the danger, apart from the misinformation aspect of it, I think I'm less bothered about the misinformation aspect of it than I am about the short headline aspect of it, because it then designs our brains, or prepares us to think about the world in ways that are incredibly simplistic, stereotypical, cliche, not complex. And so this is what I'm struggling with now, is like, how do you get people to pay attention for a second longer, for a couple of seconds longer? Like, I've probably already lost half the viewers already. Do you know what I mean? So like, this is what I'm preoccupied with at the moment.
Is that a social media problem? Is that a media problem?
Yeah.
Because I feel like the memification of the news, in some ways, it's like a mutually reinforcing thing that's happened between social media and traditional media, because a lot of the headlines are gamed to play into that cycle, to play into that short attention span. I mean, the whole sensationalist spin with the commercialization, especially in the United States, the commercialization of the news.
It's like tuning into a movie.
I will say this to anybody: make news boring again.
Yeah.
Make it boring again, so that we can, it's something that we have to sit through because it's good for us, but it's something that we process. There's something that's happened to the stories that we have telling ourselves, and to the way in which stories are presented, I think is making it difficult for people to hold complexity.
Yeah, I just want to interrogate, the limits of my engagement with the world as reflections of the limits of how information is presented to me. And I think that we are in a place where the onus is on us, actually, just to work a little bit harder. Not in a way that's sort of preachy or worthy or going off the grid or whatever, but it's just to kind of have your skepticism filter on all the time. You're like, this seems a bit too nippy, easy, too neat, too viral for it to capture all that there is about the story.
Yeah. We are going to go into questions now.
Great.
Hi, my name is Nishtana. So fake news and misinformation have become a weapon for many of those who want to peddle toxic myths and divisive narratives. But what can be the weapon for those who want to counter, challenge these divisive narratives?
So this is a question that I get asked a lot, actually. Mm. The answer is very simple. It is that we can just refuse to treat these stories or these accounts as fact. Mm. And I think, like, the thing I just plead with people to do all the time is to step back and question sources that you have no reason to question, because they are, like, respectable newspapers, they're on the newsstand. You just assume that they know what they're doing. That is not a safe assumption. When you are asked to comment, when you are asked to consume, when you're asked to engage with these stories, do not say, this is fake news. Just be like, I haven't seen the story anywhere else, So can we just, I'll need to go and look at my,
my
sources for that.
Yeah.
That is a very small thing that we can all do. And together, when you put it all together, when people do this and you multiply it, it's actually incredibly powerful.
That's a great answer. And we have another question.
Hi, everybody. What I really want to ask is, are these digital platforms kind of inherently divisive, or is there a way that we can use these platforms to fight xenophobia and fight Afrophobia and possibly work towards a new kind of Pan-Africanism using these digital tools?
This is all you.
You know, this is a really interesting question. I think, like you said at the top when you're talking about the Arab Spring, there was a moment, especially when nobody was paying attention to how Africans were using social media, there was a moment that they had tremendous power because they were intensifying this momentum that was present. Within, it's a generational shift. There are young people who want there to be this new Pan-Africanism and want there to be this new conversation about what it means to belong and to be part of this greater community.
Yeah.
But I want people to be cautious.
Yeah.
I want people to be attentive to the commercial interests that shape these platforms. They are not built to advance African democracy.
Yeah.
They're not built to advance Pan-Africanism. They're not built to advance political freedom. They're built to make money. And where there is a clash between financial interests and the political interests, what we've seen has been that the financial interest sort of runs away before the political interest has a chance to put on its shoes. And so I do believe that there is some potential for tech, because again, this other thing that people need to remember is that social media is not the internet.
Yeah.
You know, the
it's not tech.
The internet is also, you know, community forums. The internet is also listservs. The internet is also, you know, people organizing on, Telegram and Signal to have, you know, community defense. And so use it with caution.
Yeah.
Tap into the potential. Be careful about being overly reliant on the potential. That's where I would land on that. We have a next question.
Hello, Nanjala. Hello, Nisreen. My question is that, as a personal experience, it is often hard to get a visa to access to many countries. As we are people of color with what we call weak passports, how should we deal with acts of discrimination, humiliation, be it at airports or as a tourist or student in another country? Thank you so much.
You know what? It's something that just brings up, I guess, have like this visceral reaction.
Yeah, no,
when you
too.
Think about all of the humiliations that you've navigated and that you've witnessed people navigate. Just a very quick anecdote. I was recently at the airport in Nairobi, actually, and this Somali family was going through one of the things that's happened is that European governments have kind of outsourced the immigration function to airport officials in global south countries. So your first round of immigration questions is the, you know, airline ticketing agent. It's the person who checks you again before you board the plane. And this poor man had 6 kids. He had a hearing aid in, and his wife was in a wheelchair. And he was trying to get in front of the line. And the way in which the European passengers yelled at him for quote unquote cutting the line, and then the reaction of the gate staff to side with the European passengers. Mm. And I find myself in a position, being a person who doesn't like to speak when she's at the airport, I just kind of want to put on my headphones, get on the plane and sleep it off, to be in a position where you have to intervene.
Mm.
This is a decision that a lot of us have to make a lot of the times when we're at the airport, when we're at the border, when we're at the embassy. It might be you.
Mm.
You might be the person who's being humiliated.
Mm.
And I think, especially when you speak to people from the global north, they think that it's just paperwork. They think that the problem, the thing we're complaining about,
yeah,
is that we have to fill in forms.
And they think it's a privilege problem.
It's a privilege problem, yeah, right? And it's not the paperwork. It's the fact that the paperwork is designed to humiliate.
Yeah.
It's the fact that the paperwork is asking you questions that you would never have to answer if you had a different, you know, passport, if you had, if you were a different race, right? Mm. So it's, what is your grandfather's surname?
Yeah.
It is, how much money have you had in the bank for the last 2 years? It is, you know, where have you lived in the last 10 years? Where have you been? Because you couldn't have possibly been to more than two countries. And it's that humiliation that is so difficult to narrate, that is so difficult to fight back against, because a lot of us are scared to be in that moment, because what if I speak up and they don't let me in? What if I say something because my government's not going to help me?
No.
The real reality of the world we live in right now is that the border,
yeah,
is the site of some of the most casual and bureaucratized violence that is being seen anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world right now, the things that people endure when they're crossing international frontiers is, we've normalized death, we've normalized humiliation, we've normalized, you know, I mean, some of the interrogations that I've endured just for showing up Black, I couldn't, it just, you get to get a visceral reaction to it. Yeah. It's like, it takes you back to a very dark place. But I think that on a broader scale, we have to start speaking back.
Yeah.
You know, there's an injustice here that we need to address. Why does an embassy official feel empowered to shout?
I completely agree. We need to think more about talking about borders, not as sort of inevitabilities that we need to get better at bureaucratizing. We need to talk about borders as manifestations of violent apartheid, yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And what naturally comes from that is, when you realize that you have won the lottery, basically, then you are more inclined to share, because you realize that it's not your doing, that it's luck and happenstance, and that means it is your duty to help others who just fell on the wrong side of that, of that divide.
It was a wonderful conversation.
Oh my goodness, just wonderful. I'm so happy to have had this opportunity. I hope the viewers enjoyed it. I'm really grateful to the questioners.
Yes.
And hopefully in another 2 years, some of these things would have taken
and somehow something will have changed.
Social distance fist bump.
Social distance fist bump.
How can you come into my house, steal my objects, and then, you know, a few years later tell me I can't give this back to you because you might not be able to look after it? It's outrageous.
He said, my name is so-and-so from the Swedish Academy. And I said, what's this? Some kind of prank? And then he said, you have won the Nobel Prize in Literature.
What about the communities from which these objects were taken from? You know, is there anything in the media about these people? What we know is how Western Museum directors...